This week, the U.S. carries out strikes in Yemen. Iran and Pakistan clash, and Israel continues its fighting in the Gaza Strip. What's the risk of regional conflict?
Perhaps the Houthis don't understand the risk of escalation of the United States being involved in Red Sea operations.
Republican presidential candidates turn their gaze to New Hampshire after former President Donald Trump easily wins this week's Iowa caucuses.
If Nikki Haley can't win the New Hampshire primary, then like DeSantis, it's really hard to see where she turns going forward.
And what does North Korea's constitutional change mean? Join us on the Voice of America as we explore the issues in the news. Hello, I'm Steve Miller in for Lori London. This week, the United States relisted Yemen's Houthi rebels as a specially designated global terrorist group and carried out multiple strikes on targets in Yemen that Washington says posed a threat. State Department spokesperson Matthew Miller said the U.S. was working to mitigate any adverse impacts of this designation on the people of Yemen.
At the same time, we will continue to make clear to the Houthis that their attacks against commercial vessels must stop, and we will remain prepared to take additional actions if necessary.
This week's airstrikes between Iran and Pakistan mark a significant escalation in tense relations between the two neighbors, though they have since calmed. The long-running, low-level insurgencies on either side of the border have frustrated both nations. And the apparent targets of the strikes, Iran's on Tuesday and Pakistan's response on Thursday, were insurgents whose goal is an independent Balochistan for ethnic Baloch areas in Iran, Pakistan, and Afghanistan. And Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said that he objected to any Palestinian statehood that did not guarantee Israel's security. Speaking to reporters on Thursday, the Israeli Prime Minister said for three decades, his message has been clear that the conflict isn't about the absence of a Palestinian state, but the existence of Israel, and that Israel must have security over the entire territory west of the Jordan River. U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken, during his fourth trip to the Middle East, said that he had told Israeli leaders that other countries in the region are happy to provide security guarantees for Israel, but only if Israel is willing to support the creation of a Palestinian state. Joining us to discuss these developments is Craig Albert, Graduate Director of the Master of Arts in Intelligence and Security Studies at Augusta University. So, Craig, let's begin here. This week, the United States redesignated the Houthis as a terrorist organization and, you know, has since carried out several airstrikes. The rebels are also continuing to attack vessels in the close-by waters. So, you know, what exactly, as you look at this as a whole, what exactly are the dangers?
The dangers is a wider escalation of Middle Eastern conflict, bringing in not just the Houthis, but more so bringing in Iran as a direct combatant in the Israeli-Hamas conflict going on, and bringing in the United States into direct engagements against Iran because of the engagements between the Houthis and the United States naval vessels right now. So that's the biggest fear, the biggest strategic concern, is that perhaps the Houthis don't understand the risk of escalation of the United States being involved in Red Sea operations and the chances that then the United States has to engage Iran in those operations as well. And then all of a sudden you have a full global conflict happening basically very quickly.
You know, speaking of Iran, many times when we talk about the Houthi rebels, we say Iranian backed. So for our international audience who may not be as closely, you know, aware of the relationships between Iran and its various proxies throughout the region, what is the dynamic between Iran and the Houthis?
Well, Iran sends military assistance, military training, military equipment, munitions, armaments, small-scale arms, large-scale arms. So basically everything that the Houthis are getting that they're firing at merchant vessels and the United States' military vessels come primarily from Iranian or Iranian allies in the Middle East, in the MENA region. And besides that, they get some of their main finances as well from the state of Iran. So basically, they would not be able to operate without direct allowances from the state of Iran.
Craig, if we look historically at strikes, sanctions that the United States has imposed on other nations, it's situations similar to this. Have they been effective in bringing about desired changes?
Almost never. In fact, you can look at the pretty much a direct similar type of attacks when the United States would engage in what were called pinprick police actions against Al-Qaeda, for instance. When Al-Qaeda would do something, the United States would send a missile, send a couple of missiles against some infrastructure, some training camps, but they were really not strategic or really operationally sophisticated attacks. It was just like a tit-for-tat type of retaliation strike. It wasn't necessarily something that would change the strategic scope of Al-Qaeda, for instance, or they did the same thing, President George H.W. Bush and President Clinton for the state of Iraq. They would engage in these types of strikes, small strikes, retaliatory strikes, sending a message. But that message really is received as the United States is weak and is not going to do anything massive, and so we can keep operating and doing the same thing because the United States is just engaging in pinprick attacks.
Thanks for that, Craig. Before we get on to Israel, Hamas, really quickly, what's your take on the instances of fire between Pakistan and Iran?
I think it just shows a growing boldness by the state of Iran in that they're really becoming or acting more like, if we view this through strategic theory, as offensive realists would say. In other words, they're really starting to act on their ambition to become a revisionist state in the international arena. That's the surprising thing, is I think the state of Iran is seeing China engage in more operations, at least in the information domain, Russia engage in, of course, in Ukraine. All of this is trying to balance the United States' power, or at least it's acting to balance the United States' power. And now Iran is seeing an opportunity, a window of opportunity, where it can start engaging in more ambitious foreign policy, more aggressive foreign policy, where it too then can challenge the status quo of the international system, that being the hegemony or perceived unipolarity of the United States.
So as the fighting in Gaza continues, and speaking of the United States, you know, what kind of impact do you see Netanyahu's statement, about a Palestinian state, given the efforts that was put forward by Washington, and especially Secretary of State Antony Blinken and his many trips to the Middle East?
I just think it's bad timing by the United States to say that this is the way to end the situation. I mean, you have to think of how caught off guard Israel was. They're only 100 days in. So I think that is still a possibility in the future. But now he's trying to save face, saying, like, there's no way we're going to reward Palestinians with a two-state solution, even if that's going to stop the violence so quickly after Hamas did this. Because therefore, it looks like the way to win autonomy or sovereignty through terrorist actions works. And that's something that Netanyahu and the state of Israel want to avoid at all costs, is saying this is how you can achieve your objectives. So the United States, of course, promotes that two-state solution, but I think it was presented at the wrong time to the wrong audience too quickly after the events that took place on October 7th.
Do you see that this could possibly impact U.S.-Israeli ties?
Yeah, I mean, that's going to be the issue, is that Israel's going to probably be for a couple of years unwilling to engage in these types of negotiations that allow any more self-governance in the Gaza Strip. We have to remember, the Palestinians elected Hamas into office through democratic elections. So that's as close as they were to, you know, self-government and a two-state solution, was let's see how this goes. And in their mind, in Israel's mind, in Netanyahu's mind, he says this is what happens when we allow autonomy, when we allow semi or quasi sovereignty in the Gaza Strip, is that Hamas gains power. They become more emboldened and they engage in one of the deadliest, almost military invasions that the Middle East has seen. So this attack, I think, had the exact opposite intentions of what Hamas wanted, which probably was to propel more negotiations into a two-state solution or to grant more Palestinian rights.
Craig Albert is the graduate director of the Master of Arts in Intelligence and Security Studies at Augusta University in Georgia. Craig, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you very much.
You're listening to Issues in the News. I'm Steve Miller. Former U.S. President Donald Trump secured a resounding victory in the first 2024 Republican presidential contest in Iowa on Monday, asserting his dominance over the party despite a litany of legal troubles as he seeks a November rematch with Democratic President Joe Biden and ahead of next week's New Hampshire primary.
We are going to win on Tuesday at a level that maybe could even be bigger than what we just did last night in Iowa.
In the Iowa caucuses, Florida Governor Ron DeSantis edged out former UN Ambassador Nikki Haley for a second place finish in the contest after spending considerable time visiting each of Iowa's 99 counties.
And, you know, Nikki Haley said only the top two from Iowa, you know, go on to be viable. Well, guess what? We punched our ticket out of Iowa yesterday.
And while Haley did trail DeSantis by 2% in Iowa, she's polling much better in New Hampshire as she continues to campaign for change.
We have to leave the negativity and the baggage behind and go forward with new solutions for the future.
Joining me to discuss the race for the Republican nomination are Matthew Kerbel, a political science professor at Villanova University, and Rosanna Parati, political science professor at Hofstra University. Rosanna, I'd like to begin with you. And if we look back to the Iowa caucuses that wrapped up on Monday, were there any surprises that stood out to you?
No, it was pretty much a, I guess the surprise was that the polling was accurate. We wonder now about the accuracy of polling. But what was expected actually came to pass.
When you say expected came to pass, you know, we looked at the big chart of the counties that voted for each candidate. And like you say, expected came to pass. Republican frontrunner Donald Trump was expected to walk away with the Iowa caucuses, but he didn't have 100% of the vote. Rosanna, you know, did Haley's one county win surprise you?
Right. Actually, I'm very interested in the role of women in politics. She's an alternative voice at a time when Republicans are placing more attention on women. Republicans have nominated and have succeeded in getting more women in Congress in 2022. So there are real gains being made in the Republican Party for women. And I guess in the months preceding Iowa, I had thought that she might be better. But that simply didn't come to pass.
Matt Kerbel, got a question for you about Ron DeSantis, because he campaigned heavily in Iowa before the caucuses. And while he did edge out Nikki Haley by some 2%, he didn't win every single county, or any counties for that matter. You know, it was Donald Trump and Nikki Haley. So as we look forward to next week's New Hampshire primary, what's at stake for the DeSantis campaign, and really, what does he need to accomplish?
I think it's a little late to talk about what DeSantis needs to accomplish. He needed to accomplish a much better finish in Iowa than he got. Iowa is a state where Republican voters are, or the Republican electorate is composed heavily of white evangelicals. And those are the voters that DeSantis was competing with Donald Trump to win. Now, he did finish second, but he only took 21% of the vote. Going into New Hampshire, the electorate is much less favorable for him. Independent voters can cross over and vote on the Republican line if they want to. And the electorate in New Hampshire tends to be far less evangelical than in Iowa. So I really think that DeSantis has already failed in what he needed to do, and it's hard to see what he does now going forward.
So Matt Kerbel, you know, is this a two-person race then? That's what Nikki Haley says, and Ron DeSantis, you know, after his defeat, so to speak, in Iowa, said that he's the second person in the race. But given the polling, as Rosanna Parati said, it's been fairly accurate. You know, what does that say about potential outcomes for the New Hampshire primary?
Well, Donald Trump is weak in New Hampshire, too. And I think for Nikki Haley, she needs to win the New Hampshire primary. I know that she and her surrogates are trying to lower expectations and say, well, a very strong second place finish would be enough. But I think realistically, this is Donald Trump's party. And if Nikki Haley can't win the New Hampshire primary, then like DeSantis, it's really hard to see where she turns going forward. Beyond that, it's just a situation where Haley can make her case to voters who are tired of Donald Trump or looking around for someone other than Donald Trump. But as we move forward into the contest, and these primaries become winner-take-all contests, Haley would have to start winning outright in enough states to accumulate delegates.
Representative Perotti, following up on that notion about New Hampshire being a slightly different demographic, both Iowa and New Hampshire are small states relatively and not as diverse as some other areas within the United States. As this Republican nominating process moves forward, the next big primary, of course, is in South Carolina, the former home of the governor from that state, Nikki Haley. And in some seeing it as the really first big and diverse contest in this Republican nomination process, what do you see Trump, Haley, and DeSantis needing to do post New Hampshire, given that DeSantis is already turning his attention to the South Carolina state?
As in New Hampshire, Haley will have to do, she'll have to win New Hampshire or come a very close second in order to come in strong in South Carolina. And seeing as Trump is both attacking her from the left and the right on certain issues, she's going to have to do this. And seeing as Trump is kind of dangling appointments in front of other candidates who have dropped out of the race, she's going to have to do exceptionally well to keep this going. I think that both she and DeSantis, they've announced an intention to keep things going. I think there's a desire on the part of some in the party to keep them going so as to hold out the possibility that there's an alternative to Trump.
Matt Kerbel, we have, of course, been discussing the Republican Party here in the United States, but it's not the only one. The other major party, of course, is the Democrat, where Joe Biden is the presumptive nominee, even though there are some other candidates in the midst trying to run against him and get the party's nomination. Looking across the aisle, so to speak, what does the Biden campaign need to do as this race starts kicking into high gear?
Biden needs to reassemble the coalition that put him over the top in 2020. And he has quite a few months to do that. Right now, most of the political world has been focused on the Republican side, Steve, because as you say, there really hasn't been a Democratic primary race. Biden has only token opposition on the Democratic side. So effectively, he's already begun running a general election campaign. I think once the Republican side is sorted out and it becomes clear, as it appears to be, I don't want to get too far ahead of myself, but it appears that Donald Trump is likely to be the nominee of the Republican Party. Once that happens, people will start to engage in this campaign, I think, as we move into the spring and in the summer, certainly. And as they do, they're going to start to see it as a contrast between, if it's Trump, then Trump and Biden. And at that point, Biden needs to pull together the coalition that he had behind him 4 years ago. The real work of doing that will take place once the Republican field sorts itself out and we move into general campaign mode.
Matthew Kerbel is a political science professor at Villanova University, and Rosanna Perotti is a political science professor at Hofstra University. I'd like to thank you both for joining us this week, and thank you very much for your time.
Thank you, Steve.
Thank you, Steve.
This week, North Korean leader Kim Jong-un called for his country's constitution to be changed so that South Korea is seen as its primary foe and invariable principal enemy. North Korea's state-run television, KRT, on Tuesday released the video of Kim Jong-un calling South Korea, quote, the most hostile state, and warning that his country did not intend to avoid war should it happen. He added that in the event of war, South Korea would be destroyed, and the U.S. will suffer an unimaginably crushing defeat. The video was released as North Korean Foreign Minister Choi Soon-hui said during a visit to Moscow that ties with Russia were developing in line with the plans of the two countries' leaders, a deepening of a relationship that the United States and its allies view with concern. And on Friday, Pyongyang said it conducted a test of an underwater nuclear weapon system in response to a joint U.S.-South Korean military exercise. Bruce Klingner is a senior research fellow for Northeast Asia
at the Heritage Foundation. So, Bruce, I guess where I want to begin is, what is your reaction to the released video, the released statements that came out of this meeting in North Korea?
Well, it certainly is, I think, very serious, but we also have to be cautious and not overreacting. With North Korean statements, sometimes things that seem a precursor to war are not quite that dire. That said, I do think 2024 is going to be a very tumultuous year. We've seen not only this increasing rhetoric from North Korea, but also artillery fire near the maritime, northern limit line. And I think many of us just kind of get the feeling that it is going to be a more provocative year, even not ruling out the potential for a tactical military clash along the NLL or the DMZ. That said, I don't think, and also President Yoon is much more likely to respond forcefully and has said so to a North Korean provocation or clash than his predecessor, President Moon, would have done. So, but neither side nor the U.S. wants any kind of major conflict. So I think in essence, it's, you know, put on your helmet, but don't necessarily get under the desk quite yet.
So, I mean, would you label this as more or less returning to, not even returning, but more or less the status quo? Because if we look back historically over the, say 10, 15 years, there's been these wide swings of periods where there's been provocations and firing, and even going back to 2010 with the sinking of the Chunun, right? There's been limited clashes. Are we returning more, do you see, to that kind of previous environment?
Right. So North Korea and South Korea operate within a scope of action. And I think we will stay within that scope. But this year, I think, is going to be at the high end of that scope. And, you know, my concern is that a number of factors are leading to a greater potential for stumbling into more of a conflict, inadvertent escalation. So, you know, as we have the abrogation of the comprehensive military agreement and forces moving closer to each other in the DMZ, resumption of military exercises and military activities much closer to each other. So it's likely to see, as we did in the last 2 years when the Allies resumed large scale exercises, North Korea will respond more forcefully, with their own large-scale exercises, you know, near the DMZ, and sometimes even launching missiles south of the military demarcation line in the East Sea. And when I talked to South Korean officials last week, they said we can't rule out the kind of clashes we saw in 2010 with the sinking of the Chunun or the shelling of Yeongpyeongdo. And in both those times, South Korea didn't respond very forcefully. And later they said that they felt they had been sat upon by the U.S. And so if Kim is acting more forward-leaning and Yoon is, then we have the potential for not only a tactical clash, but then that escalating, though everyone wants to refrain from a major conflict. And with North Korean statements, you know, they're quite terrifying at times, but they are usually, and as has been the case recently, they're conditional of they will do very dire things if South Korea or the U.S. steps over the line. And so there's always that conditionality, even though the sort of the threat is what captures the headlines and people's attention. So, again, I think we're in for a rougher ride this year, but, no one wants to go to war.
That's Senior Research Fellow for Northeast Asia at the Heritage Foundation, Bruce Klinger. And that's going to do it for us this week. On behalf of everyone at VOA, I'd like to thank you for listening. And, you know, for more news throughout the week, you can join us on International Edition Monday through Friday or visit us anytime at voanews.com. Join us next week for more issues in the news. And until then, I'm Steve Miller.